You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett. Today we hear from writer and activist Dr. Tim Anson talking about the history of conflicts in the Middle East. Journalist Nick McCallum focusing on Sitiveni Rabuka and his Ocean of Peace, and New Caledonia, when will French decolonise in the Pacific? Journalist, activist and academic Sasha Gelislakakis with part two of his country profile of Uruguay in South America. But first, none other than Mr. Kevin Healy with his Week That Was.
A week, Jane, listener, when, as the week that was hits 42 years next month, we've been forced increasingly to concede that time and again satire can't compete with reality. But this frustrating challenge reached such a crescendo this week that we must question whether satire has any place at all anymore. How? How, listener, can satire compete with Zion Supremo Benjamin Not Another Yahoo nominating US of the UN of the US of the world Big Supremo Donald Trump or the Poor for the Nobel Peace Prize? It could only be outdone if Donald nominated Benjamin, but they, the Nobel lot, they wouldn't, would they? Then they did give it to former Zion Supremo Begin, a member of the Stern Gang, a terrorist responsible for stealing the non-land, non-people's land, for rendering them landless, and Zion maintaining the terrorism all these years, and Henry Kissinger, US of warmonger, and Barack Obama, US of warmonger. Still, they wouldn't, would they? Then again, not as glaring as the Benjamin Donald nexus, but back here, the Western Troubler Wazzy Fossil Energy Minister made a strong bid to render satire irrelevant. The federal socialists risked jeopardising Western Troubler Wazzy's green energy transition, Amber Jade Sanderson warned. So far, so good, I hear you say. But then, if it goes too far in changing federal environmental protection laws, huh? Environmental protection laws risk her green energy transition? How can we compete with that? Unless, of course, aware that the Minister for a Fossil Environment, Murray Swatch the Environment, was put there by Big Supremo Anthony Albanese to ensure environmental protection laws do not protect the environment. But then, Western Troubler Wazzy is responsible for Anthony jettisoning, on behalf of the Western Troubler Wazzy fossils, the former minister's proposal that would have at least protected the environment to some degree. As we keep saying, someone should explain to Murray that his title is actually Minister for the Environment. Thus far, he hasn't shown the slightest sign of being aware of that. No, that's unfair. Murray has headed off to Paris on a junket, or hard-working devotion to the national interest, to convince UNESCO it should grant heritage listing to the Barup Peninsula rock art. His genuine concern for the environment evident in his attack on the Save Our Songlines local indigenous group, which was urging UNESCO not to grant heritage unless Murray's gift to Woodside with profits, gas until 2070, is taken back. UNESCO, too, was inclined to reject the proposal on the tenuous grounds that the gas will destroy the thousands of years old rock art, and Murray angrily attacked Save Our Songlines for using the heritage protection to oppose poor Woodside with. It's disappointing that some environmental groups have used this World Heritage listing as a bargaining chip in a broader climate change debate. Exactly, Murray, exactly. How dare irresponsible environmental groups like the local indigenous people, this Save Our Songlines mob, use the environmental destruction of their sacred sites to oppose the environmental destruction of their sacred sites. Indeed, Murray put in his own bid in what's becoming a verbal plague, rendering satire useless. No satire, listener, he actually said, the decision made under the current laws focused on how we could protect the rock art forever. I don't accept any argument that the decision was made without regard to the rock art. That is exactly what the decision was focused on. So, just when we thought Murray's decision may have had a bit to do with guaranteeing Woodside with even greater profits until 2070, no, it was focused solely on protecting the rock art. Murray obviously didn't think it may have been just possible to protect the rock art under the current laws by not approving gas, 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 but despite his honest intent, how cruel, cruel, cruel. Manda Thanera woman, Save Our Songlines campaigner Raylene Cooper said UNESCO World Heritage experts had made it clear the Trubliwazi government needed to be serious about protecting Marajuga. That's the local Terra Nullius non-land, non-people name. But how's this for hurtful? Murray swats the environment, prioritised profits for industry. Poor Murray, attacked when he deserves praise. Having, he said, regard to the rock art, which may well be correct. He had regard and decided to disregard it. Having disregard, what better way to celebrate NAIDOC Week, ensure the Terra Nullius non-land, non-people are aware they are non-land, non-people. Despite all that, UNESCO finally backed Murray without explaining how the art will be saved from gas, gas, gas. But alas, satire shredded again. Western Trubliwazi Supremo Roger Cook the Planet made Amber, Jade and Murray, certainly not Benjamin and Donald, but who could top that? Amber, Jade and Murray seemed the very epitome of logic as Thursday he told the Western Trubliwazi gas industry at a corporate function or told a corporate function the gas industry should get more credit for its role in saving the environment. The Trubliwazi gas industry, he said, is critical to broader decarbonisation efforts. I think it's time to give up. The consequences of that fossil-led decarbonisation, extreme weather across the globe, as back in Donald's world of narcissistic myopia, there was, heaven forbid, some criticism of his cuts to weather monitoring personnel. Countered brilliantly by Donald laying the blame fairly and squarely with his predecessor, Joe Biden Capital. He didn't explain how Joe was responsible for his, Donald's enthusiastic doge lot making the cuts, but if Donald said it, it must be true. And the case was closed when his press spokesperson told the media any suggestion Donald could be responsible for people not being adequately warned was a depraved lie. Depraved. That's got to be as big and bad a lie as the human brain can imagine. And how distressed Donald would be that anyone could tell a lie, let alone a depraved lie. Donald's assiduous research and the assiduous research of his highly intelligent henchwomen and men like that press person was apparent during a visit by the Liberian Supremo, who, as all visitors must, told Donald just how wonderful and admired he, Donald, is, prompting Donald to compliment him on his English. "Where did you learn to speak so beautifully?" he asked. Didn't catch the response, but someone should tell Donald that the official language in Liberia is English. Oh, and back to Murray and the consequences of fossils saving us from fossils. To be fair to Murray, he's not just doing his bit for Terra Nullius non-land, non-people sacred sites. The government was alerted months ago by scientists that it must do something about the tragic algal bloom devastating the South Trubliwazi coast when the problem was much smaller, and ignored the plea, and continues to ignore state government and community pleas to do something. See, even-handed. Now, interesting slip of the print in the media this week. Surely it can't be true. As the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin, for instance, Monday screamed P1, attack on Trubliwazi. Then page after page of these dangerous activists, anti-Semitism run riot and trying to get set a synagogue on fire could be anti-Semitic, but the other targets were based on collaboration in the slaughter, destruction and genocide of the non-land, non-people by the Zion terrorists. But the slip of can't be true bit. In a list of good law-abiding collaborators, one article let slip that these lawless protesters had targeted a weapons manufacturer which provides an integral part for the Zion bombers laying Gaza to waste and slaughtering its non-land non-people and rendering its non-land non-people even more non-land homeless. Surely not. After all, Anthony and our right and proper minister for going overseas all the time and being a perfectly good little prefect, petty left wing, and a minister for being offensive and trained killing Richard Mall's the bad guys, he of the giant mind, have assured us time and again, true blue was he is not sending weapons to assist the slaughter by our very good friend Zion, including these parts which have been continually denied, time and again. Thank goodness we can't believe everything we read in the press or see or hear in the media. Otherwise, we'd have to conclude, have to conclude the government has been lying through its teeth. At least we could enjoy sincerity when we see it, sincere sorrow, like the Boston Consulting Group after Britain's Financial Times revealed that BCG, together with former Big Supremo Tiny Blyers Institute, had drawn up plans to turn Gaza into a thriving trading and tourist hub, the Riviera, Donald imagines, by encouraging private investment. After getting rid of the major impediment to the grand scheme, the non-land, non-people. But now the Boston Consulting Group says it is extremely sorry. Yes, when did you start to feel sorry? I'd say around about when we were sprung. Finally, spare a thought for one of the great gas behemoths doing its bit for the fossil-led decarbonisation. Chevronged by its workforce, whom it so cares about. The evil unions have lodged a case calling for Labour hire workers to receive equal pay under the same job, same pay legislation. If the evil unions get their way, the Labour hire workers could cost an extra $80,000 a year. After all, the great corporates tell us Labour hire is used to fill in temporary gaps, so why would the Western Troubler Wazzy ETU Secretary Adam Woodidge say the Labour hire workers have been working side by side with Chevron direct workers for years? $80,000 a year. Surely that doesn't mean, I am trying to think of another possibility, but I just can't think of one, that gas, oh, and other fossils chevronged must be ripping those workers off to the tune of $80,000. They wouldn't, would they? Good afternoon.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favourite radio program is produced? On Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2025. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 25th and Saturday 26th of July. See you then.
Living with arthritis can bring tough questions. How do I manage the pain? What treatments work? Will it ever get better? It can feel overwhelming. That's why the Arthritis Info Line is here to help. It's a toll-free service with trained staff who understand arthritis and can provide answers, support, and resources. If you're living with arthritis or caring for someone who is, call 1-800-011-041 or visit arthritisaustralia.com.au/infoline. You don't have to face it alone.
A 3CR supporter.
The war on Palestine has not stopped. Palestinians need self-determination. Gaza must be free of Israeli occupation forces, have unconditional access to aid and reconstruction. 17 years of Israeli siege must end.
The West Bank needs the violence and attacks by the Israeli army and settlers to stop. and an end to the occupation and apartheid.
Your support to end the war on Gaza to bring peace, justice and freedom to all of Palestine is needed more than ever.
Converge on Canberra, 20th to the 22nd of July. Sanction Israel. Join the united call to sanction the state of Israel in response to the genocide on Palestine.
With Netanyahu and Trump threatening to ethnically cleanse Gaza and annex the West Bank, we all need to stand up and say no.
Converge on Canberra, 20th to the 22nd of July. Sanction Israel.
With your support, Palestine will be free, from the river to the sea.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Now we return to what the Western world calls the Middle East, and I'm speaking with activist and author Tim Anderson. Tim, the first issue is Iran and the State of Israel. What was the situation between the two countries at 1948?
Of course, the Israelis started their ethnic cleansing earlier than the state, back in the 1930s, with the assistance from Nazi Germany. Back then, you recall, there was an agreement between the Zionists and the Nazis, which was not supported by the largest Jewish organization in Germany. But the Zionists wanted to move people and capital out of German-occupied areas into Palestine, basically. There was an agreement, a transfer agreement, called the Havara Agreement, which facilitated that. So there was this ethnic cleansing going on. During this time, you know, with Iran, the problem is that there was a social democratic government in the late 40s and early 50s in Iran, and then a coup in Iran in 1953, I think it was. And that coup led to the installation of the king, the Shah of Iran, who was basically a US puppet in many respects. And after, not so much after 48, but after 53, there was very strong support for the Israeli regime until the Iranian Revolution in 1979. From the coup in the US and British orchestrated coup in Iran in 53 until the Iranian Revolution in 1979, there were very strong relationships between the monarchy in Iran and the Israeli regime. And you see that today in the Shah's son, the so-called crown prince, who is very strong supportive of the Israelis, basically. So monarchist and Zionist is the character of the mainstream Iranian opposition in exile these days. And of course, one other thing, the US was supporting a nuclear program in Iran back in those days before the Iranian Revolution.
But then again, why does Israel see Iran as such a threat?
Only since the Iranian Revolution, since 1979, built into its constitution and all its policies the support of the Palestinian people, it was considered a principle based on Quranic principles of supporting the Mustadafin, the oppressed people of the world, because Iran saw Palestine as an extension of the Muslim world, basically. And indeed, it is, you know, 95% Sunni Muslim. So it wasn't a sectarian thing to do with Shia and Sunni. It was to do with Iran's view of Palestine as the most oppressed part and occupied part of the Muslim world, basically. Since 1979, with a whole lot of facilities like Al-Quds Day, where they asked all Muslims to recognize a day in support of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, the holy city, in support of the Palestinian people, the delivery of aid in many, many respects, including arms to the Palestinian resistance to defend themselves against the Israeli ethnic cleansers. Basically, Iran has been the key state. I saw just the other day that Low Key, the musician in Britain, says there's no other state in the world that has sacrificed so much in support of the Palestinian people, because if they weren't doing that, there would have been a much greater chance for the US and Western normalization with the Iranian Revolution. But they committed themselves from the beginning to support the Palestinian cause, and they kept doing that. And that includes other independent peoples in the region who weren't occupied, like the Yemeni revolution, and like Syria when it was independent, and like Iraq when it was trying to get independence from the US occupation.
Well, what's the history of Iran attacking Israel? Is there a history?
No, there's not really much history at all of Iran directly attacking Israel. What they've done is that they've supported and built the capability of the Palestinians and the independent peoples and states of the region, including the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah in Lebanon, where The Israelis have been invading. They've done five or six invasions of Lebanon in the last few decades. And of course, Syria also. They've been occupying Syrian territory since the 60s, and they've extended that in recent times since the Al-Qaeda takeover in Syria. So, but the Iranians have not directly engaged until recently, when the Israelis attacked them on June 13th, Friday the 13th in June, and then they responded. They had retaliated to the Israelis previously for an Israeli attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus and for a number of assassinations the Israelis carried out, but they were really demonstrative attacks which were testing the Israeli defenses. So the first substantial retaliation, or you could call it an attack, but attack and retaliation, was after the Israeli surprise or sneak attack on Iran on June the 13th. Only then have we seen a substantial Iranian assault against the Israeli institutions.
And the fact that a number of high-profile Iranians have been killed, including those in the nuclear industry. There's never been anyone in Israel actually harmed by Iran. Is that correct?
There's been ongoing terrorism basically by the Israelis against Iran. Of course, the spies, they've captured a number of spies. More recently, quite a lot of them, they've executed a number of Mossad spies. And so there's been an ongoing low-level war basically between the two, but no direct attack on the Israelis. Now, you see, I think if you're talking about Israelis being harmed, you might notice that the Israelis are saying, oh, the Iranians attacked us and they targeted civilian areas. And all you see from the media is that some destruction in residential areas, because Israeli military censors don't allow media to show the facilities, the infrastructure and the military facilities that were hit, basically. But all you have to do is look at the figures, which are admitted in the Israeli media as much as the Iranian media, that I think 28 Israelis were killed in that recent exchange, what they call the 12-day war, and 935 Iranians were killed. So if we're talking about people being harmed, it's always been the Israelis as the aggressors there.
Well, Israel's not going to give up, is it?
No, I don't think so, because strategically, although the pretext has been the idea of a nuclear weapon, you know, this recycling of this weapons of mass destruction threat, you know, which we were all subject to with before the invasion of Iraq, and also with the dirty war in Syria, the chemical weapons thing was something that was recycled constantly to try and portray these independent states, independent peoples, as some sort of threat to the West, and therefore there was a self-defense rationale. You know, remember all of the media prior to the invasion of Iraq was saying that there was an imminent threat to Western states from weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They've been doing the same thing with Iran, but for longer, actually, since at least the 1990s. Netanyahu's got a track record of this. So the aim has never been, though, about to stop Iran developing a nuclear weapon, because Iran has the strongest ideological commitment against nuclear weapons and a fatwa, you know, a religious decree saying this is immoral, which of course makes it very hard for the Iranians to have any credibility to threaten anyone with a nuclear weapon when they've been saying this for 4 decades. The whole nuclear issue has been a pretext to try and disempower Iran in the region because of the support of Iran for the Palestinian people and for their support of Hezbollah in Lebanon, their support of Yemen, the revolutionary government in Yemen and so on, and independent Syria when it was independent. So really the aim is the US and their Israeli colony has been to take the Iranian factor out of the power politics in the region, basically, which is a much bigger thing. And that's why they've begun to talk since June 13th. The Israelis have begun to talk more openly, and the US also more openly, about so-called regime change, you know, a war of aggression to topple the government of Iran.
So what you're saying is, in the last years, the elephant in the room has been the US in this issue between Iran and Israel.
Some people say the Israelis have more agency, and a lot of critical North Americans are saying this is a regime, the Israeli regime, that is corrupting and diverting our state. But I think a lot of the more informed observers from outside say, well, the Israelis have always acted as a forward base for the Anglo-American world, you know, first the British and then the North Americans, basically. And so while there can be difference about who controls who, I think the better informed verses say that the US is behind it, basically, and the Israelis are always looking for a green light or permission to do what they did. And I think that the recent visit of Netanyahu to Washington just reinforces this, that there's going to be a second round. The Israelis are not happy. Both sides claimed victory after the 12-day war, but the Israelis are not happy that Iran is still a powerful presence and still supporting the Palestinians and supporting the rebuilding of Hezbollah and so on. So they're unhappy with that. They'll try a second round, even though they got smashed very badly in the first round in the 12-day war. But somehow they're stocking up on their weapons now. That's why observers are saying, some of the better informed observers are saying, it's going to take a little while to stock up all those very expensive anti-air mechanisms, basically made in the US, most of them, to try and intercept a greater percentage of the Iranian missiles. I think the Israelis admitted that at least 14% of the missiles got through, which is something like 70 missiles slamming into their facilities there. They know that they were hurt. Of course, the civilians know that too. That's why many of them have been fleeing to Cyprus. Now they've created a new crisis in Cyprus, basically, because people in Cyprus are now worried about their land being taken over by these fleeing political refugees, basically. But the second round is expected to take place somewhere, perhaps around September, because the Israelis need some time to stock up on those very expensive weapons.
What about Iran stocking up?
There's also, of course, the weakness in Iran is the Israeli advantage has been, and most dramatically with when they were attacking Lebanon, is that Lebanon has no air defense, basically, and the Israelis have a very powerful military aircraft, basically. So similarly with Iran, but not to the same degree, because Iran does have some air defense, but nevertheless, the US has managed to clear the way for them across Syria and Iraq. The US occupation in both Syria and Iraq means that the Israeli aircraft had free air, basically, to go all the way to Iran and fire missiles into Iran from their sophisticated jets. Now, the Iranians have been waiting on a delayed shipment of Russian fighters from Russia, but it hasn't come through. Of course, Russia's preoccupied. They've got another war going on there. Perhaps they're concerned to preserve their own assets. But in the meantime, Iran has gone to China for air defense and fighter craft. China has been helping the Iranians for some time in their missile technology, perhaps components for missile technology, because most of the Iranian missiles are homegrown. But nevertheless, they need components and they need support, and the Chinese have been helping them with that.
Many commentators say that the US and Israel has gone through those countries in the Middle East, starting from Northern Africa right through Lebanon, Syria, other countries as well. Do the Iranians feel that they're the last cab on the rank?
No, the idea of the last cab on the rank is a North American view, basically, that it came out, I suppose, when the former General Wesley Clark revealed in the early 2000s that the Iraq War, which had nothing to do with 9/11 or whatever, of course, 9/11 was a pretext for a whole series of wars, but he heard when he was concerned about why the US is about to invade Iraq, one of his former officials said to him that there's going to be seven countries in 5 years, and Iran was the last there on that list. But from a North American point of view, from a Pentagon point of view, Iran was the most powerful, the most difficult independent state to deal with, and that's why they were going to try and knock off Syria and Iraq, less powerful independent states in the region first, basically. So from the North American point of view, from the Pentagon, or from a US hegemonic point of view, you could say that Iran is the last cab on the rank in the sense that it's the most powerful and the last one they would come to after, including some North American states, North African states, as you said, as well as the ones they've already tried regime in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and so on.
Well, just how powerful do you believe Iran is?
Iran is a very powerful country. It's developed its capacity since the revolution, when, remember, the US was behind the Saddam Hussein's attack on Iran, supposedly over some border disputes, territorial disputes, but really an attempt to weaken the new Iranian revolutionary regime in the 80s. And that was a terrible war which went on for 8 years, but effectively Iran didn't give up anything. And Iran was very weak at that stage. But since that time, it's developed its economy, its military capacity, its technological capacity. It's invested very heavily in, this isn't widely recognized in the West, but the investment in education and technical education and training in Iran has been enormous. You know, the human development advances in Iran have been enormous. I know there's a focus on supposedly the exclusion of women from positions of influence, but really, and there's something to that, but the thing is the education of girls and boys in Iran has been astonishing, and the level of university education has been astonishing, and that's behind the industrial developments of Iran and the military and technological developments of Iran. So they have quite a powerful military, as we saw in the 12-day war, we saw that the most sophisticated air defense in the world, basically provided by the US and by Germany and Britain, was insufficient to stop those Iranian missiles crashing into some of the important infrastructure in Israel. So Iran is a power. It's not invincible. It has some weaknesses, but it also has some important allies in China and Russia. There's always been a fear. Of course, the Israelis didn't dare to attack Iran just as themselves, because the Israelis are a very small outpost in many respects. They'd always relied on Western support to intervene in their support. And I think they were quite one reason for their false optimism at the moment and their contemplation of a second round, which could be disastrous for them. They succeed in getting Trump to intervene in their war when Trump intervened to bomb the nuclear sites at the end of that 12-day war and then brought an end to that, which many say was really effectively saving the skins of the Israelis, basically because Israelis were being punished so much by the Iranian missiles that they were in danger of being, their military was in danger of being wiped out, basically. And they're certainly weakened now, and their key refineries are gone. So there are many weaknesses the Israelis face, but they were saved by Trump. And I think Netanyahu, at least the elite, Netanyahu, if not the masses, but people like Netanyahu are claiming victory because they were able to attack Iran directly and survive. And they incited the US, in this case Trump, to get involved in their support. So I think that's part of the reason for their being, you know, a cock-a-hoop after being hit so heavily.
But it's not just Iran that Israel is attacking, it's the other countries in the Middle East as well. Where do they get the know-how and the armaments and the manpower, I suppose, to continue these wars around the region?
Well, they have a weakness in the manpower, and of course we know where they get their weapons from. They get them from the US and from Germany and from Britain, and to a lesser extent Australia contributes components for their fighter jets. So there's a very strong, you could say, US NATO and the NATO hangers-on alliance that keeps arming them, keeps supporting them, of course, diplomatically and protecting them in international forums too, despite the overwhelming collapse of their soft power. I mean, most of the world hates them now because of the genocide that is still being exposed in Gaza, basically. And the view of the Israelis is a very dim one in most of the world. Most countries of the world is huge. But of course, the elites of the world don't always follow what their populations think, you know. So there is still this strong support from Western regimes for what is, after all, an outpost of US influence in the region. And the fear, and you've heard it expressed from people like Joe Biden and RFK Jr. in the US, that if they don't support the Israelis, they're going to surrender the region, this is the way they look at it, to some other powers like Iran, Russia and China. Not that they will lose access to all the resources of the region, because they could buy them, like they could buy Iraqi oil when Saddam Hussein was there. Why was that not enough for them? They're not happy with the idea of some wild card or some independent regime there, you know, whether to the left or the right, whatever. They don't like independent regimes. The US effectively is trying to run a global dictatorship, and they will attack anyone who is outside that. There's actually a Pentagon military doctrine which is about destroying a disconnectedness. It was announced, it was elaborated in a book back in 2004, Destroying Disconnectedness, and another one from 2000, Dominance in All of the Ambits of, you know, Ideological, Economic and Military and so on. So that's the way the US sees the world. That's why they have something called CENTCOM, based in Qatar, in the US military base in Qatar, which is effectively trying to militarily dominate the whole Middle East region.
I did read one report which claimed that over 100,000 Americans are serving in the IDF. Could you verify that?
Yes, I can't give you the exact numbers. It's true that there's an awful lot. And also, of course, we have private contractors like the ones that went into this so-called Gaza Humanitarian Fund, which has been widely denounced as a killing field, basically, that I think they've killed several hundred, maybe 700 or 800 civilians trying to get aid, set up by the Israelis and the US together as a joint thing. In all of these operations, the whole operation in Gaza, the CENTCOM commander, the US general that's in charge of the region, basically, is regularly collaborating with Israeli military. In fact, since the resistance attacks of October the 7th, 2023, there's a very strong argument that basically CENTCOM and therefore the US is effectively running the military in Israel. They couldn't survive by themselves. They're, since October 2023, almost 2 years now, they've really been heavily dependent on foreign support. So there's a lot of private contractors engaged in these new experiments in Gaza. Remember, there was an attempt to build a naval port on the basis that it was going to deliver aid. It did nothing of the sort. It failed. Now there's this Gaza humanitarian operation which is killing civilians. Now there's a new operation to try and build a new concentration camp within southern Gaza, which is really effectively just trying to steal more land and restrict the borders of Gaza more, because Gaza has been a concentration camp for many, many years. They haven't allowed access to the sea, for even for fishermen and so on. So all of these operations are really underwritten and supported militarily and in infrastructure terms by the US. That's why it wouldn't be correct, really, in my view, to see Israel as an independent state, really. It's really only operating because it has this massive foreign support. And second after the US is Germany, basically, which has its own peculiar history with the Israelis.
You are listening to Tuesday Home Time on Melbourne Community Radio Station 3CR. My name is Jan Bartlett, and I'm speaking with activist and author Tim Anderson about the relationship of Israel with many of the countries in the region. You've been over in the region for over a month. Tim, where did you go? Who did you talk to? What did you see?
I was in Lebanon recently, looking at what was happening in Lebanon, in Syria, in terms of the regional resistance, and waiting on a trip to Yemen, which was postponed because the Israelis have destroyed many of the planes that were flying into Yemen, into independent Yemen, I mean, because Yemen itself is... there's a revolutionary government which is basically supervising about three quarters of the populated areas of the region. And the other quarter, or 20-25%, is occupied by proxy armies backed by the United Arab Emirates and the Saudis and the US to a certain degree. You know, so in Yemen, there has been a resurgence of resistance strength there. You know, the Yemenis are carrying out these Red Sea operations to prevent resupply of the genocidal regime in Israel. They say they don't need anyone's permission to do this because there is indeed a convention on the prevention and punishment of genocide, which requires the state signatories to act immediately without any authorization from the Security Council to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. So they've been operating independently, and of course they've been talking to the resistance in Palestine, in Lebanon, talking to Iran also. So there's a whole constellation of groups, resistance groups, which from the Iranian point of view, they've called the Axis of Resistance, because earlier on the US had called them an Axis of Evil. They were saying Iran, Iraq and North Korea, whatever independent countries, this idea of an Axis of Evil came out of the George W. Bush regime. The Iranians co-opted that and called it an Axis of Resistance. And so that constellation has been changing over times. Effectively, Syria was taken out of the equation in December last year when an al-Qaeda coup happened, basically in Damascus, and therefore the supply of weapons to the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine dried up from the Syrian side. But at the same time, we saw a resurgence of support for the Palestinians and the regional resistance from Yemen. The Yemeni officials themselves say our responsibility has increased with the fall of Damascus. You have resistance groups in Iraq, you have Iran as the big patron of independent groups there, and therefore the key evil in the view of Washington and the Israelis to be taken out of the picture, using the same sort of pretext they've used for years. You know, they used the nuclear scare with Libya, they used it with Iraq, you know, they used the chemical weapons scare with Syria, and they're using the nuclear scare for Iran now. So these are just pretexts to try and advance the constellation of forces towards what Condoleezza Rice called 20 years ago a new Middle East. Remember Condoleezza Rice, she was Secretary of State to George W. Bush, and she spoke of the use of a creative chaos in the region, creative chaos and creative destruction, to try and change the constellation of forces in the region towards a new Middle East, which in the view of Washington was basically the elimination of any independent regimes from Iraq to Libya to Syria, and the installation of a region dominated by their key players, the Israelis and the Saudis in particular. You know, so an ugly sort of constellation, but in the view of Washington, this was
a free region open for, you know, democracy and human rights, whatever they want to call it, basically, but dominated by the Israelis and by the Saudis. It's only been the independent peoples and the states of the region that have been resisting this and are still resisting this. And Trump has recycled the term. He's borrowed the term again. He hasn't really brought much new to, despite all of his rhetoric, to the region. He's even using the rhetoric of the Bush regime, the new Middle East, in terms of expanding the influence of the Israelis and turning a blind eye to them trying to annex even greater parts of Syria, for example, and occupying more parts of southern Lebanon still.
Is there any plans to take over the whole of Lebanon? I could imagine they'd like that coastline on the Mediterranean.
Yeah, they've always had an ambition, at least for the south of Lebanon, at least for the south of Lebanon. But if you look back at Herzl and even some of the more recent Zionists, they're talking about the original dream, which is written into the Israeli flag. You look at the Israeli flag, there's the Star of David. It doesn't appear anywhere in their religious text, but it's borrowed from some other types of history and occult sources and so on. But that Star of David is in between two blue lines, which in Zionist mythology is the Brook of Egypt or the Nile to the Euphrates. So you will see some of them in in some plans, and some ideologues in recent times still talking about that. And some of the ministers in the current Israeli regime, Smotrich, for example, talking about that they really, Lebanon is theirs, Damascus is theirs, and right across to the Euphrates, which is on, you know, the border, near the border, crossing the border of Syria and Iraq, basically, and including some parts of the Arabian Peninsula, including even Mecca and Medina, the holy Muslim cities, basically. So that Israeli flag represents a colonial ambition to the region. That's another reason why it's hated in the region by the independent Arab and Muslim peoples there, that those two blue lines on either side of the Star of David on the flag represent the greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates.
But then you have the Christian part of Lebanon, where the French were the colonizers. What are they thinking about these plans of Israel?
No one in Lebanon, despite the fact that you have a minority faction which is very pro-North American, like they call it the American bus there, basically, which is the extreme right-wing Christians. But no, not even they are talking about surrendering Lebanon to the Israelis, basically. There's no appetite. There's a very right-wing prime minister at the moment, Sunni Muslim man. Lebanon is very sectarianized, but there's no appetite in any of the communities and there is a, you know, plurality, a big diversity of religious communities in Lebanon, mainly Muslim these days. It's not dominated by Maronite Christians as it was to begin with, but there's no appetite amongst any of them for Israel taking over. But there's less concern about the south, which is more Shia Muslim, but there are Christians in the south. There's no one that's going to accept this in Lebanon, even though Lebanon is a very weak state and weakened by its structure that the French set in place, as you pointed out, that they set in place this artificial Maronite Christian majority. It used to be a majority, now it's a minority, now it's about 35% Maronite Christian. So no one's going to accept that there, basically. None of the countries in the region are going to accept it. Not even Jordan, which is a very close collaborator. You know, it's a monarchy in close collaboration with the US. It's got US military bases there. But they don't like the idea of being taken over by the Israelis either, you know, nor Egypt. Egypt doesn't want to accept, for all the fact that they collaborate with the US military and the Israelis, they don't accept the plans of the US and the Israelis to drive Palestinians out of Gaza into Egypt too. That's not something that the current Egyptian regime wants at all. So the Israelis are pushing up against some form of resistance everywhere in the region, basically, even though most of the Arab regimes are too cowardly to actually engage directly or to support the resistance these days. But still, the ambitions of the Israelis are so fantastic, you know, megalomaniacal, really. You know, you hear the speech of these extremist ministers, and they're just saying in the open what most of the other Zionists in Israel these days are saying, just as Trump is saying many things openly now, which have been always part of a North American agenda, but the liberal faction in the US doesn't like the crudeness and the vulgarity of Trump saying these things openly, mirrored in Israel.
Well, just finally, Tim, Syria, over 6 months now since the takeover by the, I don't know what you call them now. He's looking very nice with his trim beard and his suit and tie.
Jalani changed his name and changed his clothes, that's right, and combed the fleas out of his beard a little bit. And that, there was a British MI6 NGO, basically, which was trying to help him brush up his appearance. But that's been going on for some time. I think some of the US media, including NPR, were trying to brush him up a couple of years back there. Maybe they weren't as sure as they are now that he was... They still haven't recognized him officially, by the way. He's because he was an ISIS leader and Al-Qaeda in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, which changed his name to HTS. So he's an Al-Qaeda leader, which they've installed without any election, without any actual revolution. But really, it was a coup, effectively, because Syria was so weak, occupied by three armies, the two biggest NATO armies and the Israelis. They managed to corrupt the army command, basically, to take it over, and really... They've destroyed the Syrian military, which wasn't the strongest in the region, but nevertheless it prevented the Israelis from going into their airspace because one jet was shot down, and so they were firing missiles into Syria from the Mediterranean across Lebanon, which has no air defense at all, basically. And now they're using Syrian airspace to attack, to fly across to attack Iran. So that you can see the, and in fact the U.S., began to openly acknowledge what their agenda was in overthrowing Assad after all this time, was that they've taken out a link in the mail of the resistance, that that the Syrian government was in fact not just transporting weapons to Hezbollah and to the Palestinian resistance, but manufacturing them in Syria. And so they've taken that link out of the axis of resistance there. As I said, that's gone in regional terms, but Yemen has appeared as a quite well-armed, although fairly new, revolutionary government in the region, which has no fear of engaging directly, even with the US warships there. And they drove US warships out of the Red Sea, basically. They harassed them until fighter jets were falling off the decks of the aircraft carrier. And although they didn't manage to sink any of the US or British warships, they harassed them and drove them out of the Red Sea. Trump gave up, effectively. So Yemen has filled the gap in a way that that appeared with the destruction of the independent Syrian state.
But where does Israel fit into this?
Israel was in coordination with Erdogan in Turkey and the US, those three occupying powers in Syria who were trying to starve the Syrians and weaken the Syrians, basically. And after the Israelis failed to invade South Lebanon, there was a very fierce defense with a lot of loss of life in South Lebanon. It's destroyed. Many parts are destroyed, like Gaza. They look like Gaza, really. I was down there earlier this year. Terrible destruction. But nevertheless, the resistance forces, which was Hezbollah, Amal, the other Shia Muslim group, and many of the Palestinian factions in Lebanon, repelled the Israelis from invading South Lebanon, but at terrible cost, because the Israelis had control of the skies and they could bomb if even if they couldn't take over the villages. They are still embedded in parts of the border, the area there now, and they're trying to prevent the Lebanese from rebuilding and going back to the area. But they didn't manage to invade. And let's remember back in the 80s, in the early 80s, when the Israelis invaded, they just went straight through to Beirut back in 1982, basically, whereas late last year, they couldn't get even take over some of those towns near the border down there, but they could bomb from the air, and they bombed Beirut from the air, you know. So the Israelis are still there in South Lebanon, and they haven't respected the ceasefire that was created there, just as in Gaza they didn't respect the ceasefire, just as in Iran they don't expect them to respect the ceasefire that was unilaterally imposed by Trump anyway, but to give the Israelis a chance to recuperate a little bit. From the Iranian point of view, they were simply falling back onto their self-defense rationale, saying, well, if the Israelis stopped attacking us, we will stop hitting them back, basically. But there's no real serious ceasefire in the region for any of those elements of the resistance.
But what about taking land from Syria?
You know that the international community, despite whatever Trump had said, the international community never accepted the Israeli occupation of the Golan region, which was the Golan Heights, which they took over in 1967 in that war back then, when they occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank. With the collapse of Damascus, went in further. They occupied Kenetra, part of which was liberated by the Syrians back in 1973. They went through to Jabal al-Sheikh and Mount Hermon. That's the highest part of the of that area there. They got up very close to Damascus. So there are large parts of South Syria that are still occupied by the Israelis, but The problem they face is this, that first of all, there's no international appetite for recognizing their invasion and annexation of South Syria, even though de facto they've done it. Secondly, the Al-Qaeda regime in Damascus, led by Jalani al-Shara, is not recognized by any state yet, even though the Western governments have really sidled up to him and have begun to lift the economic blockade that was on the Syrian people, effectively. And so there's the possibility of some investment from the Arab monarchies in the Persian Gulf, like the Emirates and the Saudis, for example. But there's no official recognition. So apparently the Damascus regime, led by al-Shara Jalani, is on the verge of trying to recognize or normalize with the Israelis, talking to them, normalize with them and hand over part of the Golan, which is going to be a great betrayal for the Syrian people, of course. It may incite a revolt within the al-Qaeda groups because some of them, remember, think they're on some holy mission there. There's been this jihadi ideology amongst some of them, particularly the foreign fighters from Chechnya and from Albania and from the Uyghurs from West China and so on, thinking they are there in some sort of holy mission to liberate Jerusalem, Al-Quds. But when they find Jalani is betraying them by giving parts of Syria to the Israelis, there may be a conflict within those groups there. So that hasn't happened yet, but it's really, it's on the cards. It's what the sponsors of the HTS regime in Damascus want, what the US and what Erdogan and the Israelis, even though there's some conflict amongst the sponsors. That is to say, Erdogan has his own ideas of being the hegemonic controller again in the region, you know, like the Ottoman Empire was. And the Israelis want to annex more of South Syria because that's what Greater Israel is all about. So there's some conflict between all of those. Perhaps the US wants greater legitimacy for some weak puppet regime in Damascus, as they've tried to do in Iraq with some success, but not complete success. So it remains to be seen exactly what's going to happen with that regime in Damascus. But certainly the sponsors are all pushing them towards, indeed, they've allowed the air defences of Syria and a lot of the key defence installations to be destroyed by the Israelis after the takeover of Damascus. So, but it remains to be seen what's going to be put up in its place, whether the US, for example, is going to be happy to allow Syria to look like Libya with ongoing, you know, warlords and factions for years and years, or whether they'll try and create some sort of semblance of a weak but notionally independent state like in Iraq, which they managed to federalize and dismantle some of the key national institutions in Iraq. So the fate of Syria is rather uncertain. There's some resistance there, but it's weak and fragmented at the moment. The Syria's ultimate sort of the form of a state there is still up in the air.
Great. Thanks, Tim.
You're welcome, Jen.
And Dr. Tim Anderson is a former academic, now a writer.
Comrades, friends, siblings all over this continent, I urge every one of you to join us in Canberra. I refuse to be silent while Gaza is being annihilated. History will judge us all. No one will be able to say they didn't know, that they didn't see, that they didn't hear. The screams and pain are reaching every one of us from the screens we hold in our hands. Now is the time to act, July 20. I urge, I beg each and every one of you, each person of good conscience, to stand with us in Canberra. Together we can send this simple, clear message. The Albanese government must sanction Israel now. When governments fail, responsibility falls upon the citizenry to act. If we don't stand up now, then when? Join us in Canberra, July 20. It's time for the Albanese government to sanction Israel.
People tasted freedom, soon those hellish skies turn to blue and starry nights as our voices start to rise. We're ending an apartheid.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a container deposit scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Melbourne Documentary Film Festival returns to Cinema Nova this July for Past, Present, Future. Beginning on July 15, warm up the cold winter days with a revitalising collection of local and international documentaries from independent and emerging talents. Melbourne Documentary Film Festival, a jewel in Melbourne's cultural crown. Screening from July the 15th for a limited time at Cinema Nova, 380 Lygon Street, Carlton. Cinema Nova is a 3CR supporter.
The Prime Minister of Fiji, Sitiveni Rabuka, has proposed a declaration on the Pacific as an ocean of peace at this year's Pacific Islands Forum in September. When I spoke with Nick McClellan, journalist with Islands Business, I pointed out that he hasn't always been a man of peace.
Sitiveni Rabuka has a long history as a military officer. He served both in Fiji and in peacekeeping operations under the United Nations. Fiji has a long history of sending people from the Fiji military forces to participate in UN operations overseas. And Rabuka served particularly in Lebanon, leading troops as part of UNIFIL, which was the United Nations interim force in southern Lebanon between Israel and northern Lebanon. Infamously, he was involved in the 1987 coups. There were two coups, first in May 87 and then again in September 87, a few months later. Overthrow of the democratically elected government led by Timothy Bavandra, the Labour Party, was a significant change in Fijian culture, politics, history. And Rabuka, you know, made some unholy alliances at that time. For example, Australia and New Zealand both cut military aid to Fiji after the coups, and yet France stepped in at that time under the Jacques Chirac government in France, providing a range of military equipment, including Renault trucks, helicopters, a range of non-lethal equipment to the Fiji military to make up for the cutbacks from Australia and New Zealand. So Rabuka played also a crucial role in the lead up to the 2000 coup. I was living in Fiji at that time, and there was a lot of concern that the members of the group called known as the Counter-Revolutionary Warfare Unit, which was part of the Fiji military forces, had trained on Rabuka's policy in the lead up to their takeover of parliament in 2000. By this time, Rabuka himself was out of politics, but you know, he's been a significant figure. And of course, recently he's returned to parliamentary politics, defeating the Bainimarama government during recent elections and holding office as head of a three-member coalition.
So let's talk now about his ocean of peace. What changed him? His points of view? Or has he always had those points of view in a sense?
Well, there's a change of rhetoric, certainly, on his part. You know, Fiji has always been an important player on the international stage and in terms of international diplomacy. You know, after Papua New Guinea, Fiji is the largest Pacific Island country in terms of population, in terms of economy. And Fiji, going back to the days of independence in 1970, has been a very active player in international affairs. You think of the government led by Prime Minister Ratu Kamisesimara, the first Prime Minister of Fiji, during his early days, before he turned a bit conservative, as politicians often do. You know, Fiji was very active in negotiations over what became the Lome Treaty, so trade agreements between Pacific countries and the European Union. Fiji joined Australia and New Zealand to take France before the International Court of Justice in 1973 over its nuclear testing at Mururoa and Fangataufa atolls. Fiji was really, really a crucial player in the creation of the Law of the Sea. In 1982, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea was established, of vital importance for Pacific Island states. And Ambassador Sachin Anand, Fiji's ambassador, became the first head of the International Seabed Authority. So Fiji has historically been involved in international diplomacy. And so Rumbuka's current initiatives talking about branding the Pacific as an ocean of peace at a time of international confrontation sort of fits within that tradition.
Where is this going from here, though, Nick?
This idea has been tossed around a lot, and the plan is that it will be addressed at this year's Pacific Islands Forum leaders meeting. Every year, the presidents, prime ministers and premiers of the region come together for an annual discussion, and there's a private retreat where just the leaders go into a room by themselves with no officials and so on, and thrash out trying to develop a regional consensus on key issues. It's likely that a draft document will go to the meeting, which is held in Honiara, Solomon Islands, in early September. And that'll be the basis of a declaration talking about the Ocean of Peace. While people generally are supportive of the idea from discussions I've had around the region, there's an awful lot of questions about the substance of this. You hear Donald Trump talk about peace, but he talks about peace through strength, peace through deterrence, i.e. building up nuclear arsenals to threaten Iran or Russia or China and so on. The very notion of peace is contested, and that's really at the heart of the discussions that are going on behind closed doors at the moment. Many church and civil society groups, particularly women's groups, are involved in this discussion in countries like Fiji, raising questions about, you know, when we talk about peace, are we also talking about justice? You know, the old slogan, no justice, no peace, is pretty common around the world. You see it during Black Lives Matter movements and other civil rights movements and so on. And that's very much the sentiment. You know, how can you talk about peace in the Pacific without talking about elements of injustice within the region? One of the most obvious of those is the plague of violence against women and children and other people in the home, the workplace, the community. Serious problem about violence against women. You know, how can you have peace without fundamentally addressing the patriarchal imbalance of power in that situation? Others, for example, in New Caledonia, French Polynesia, in Guam, have raised the question, how can you talk about an ocean of peace when there are still colonial powers administering territories? The United States, New Zealand, even France have maintained colonial administrations well into the 21st century. And as we saw last year in New Caledonia with 6 months of conflict and armed clashes, protests on the streets, roadblocks and so on by CANAC protesters against French security forces, the notion of peace in that context looks pretty thin. So I think there's going to be a lot of debate about whether this declaration has any substance or whether it's still just gilding the lily to avoid those hard-nosed discussions about substance.
And when you think about Australia as a Pacific nation and our commitment to AUKUS and things like that, where do we fit into an ocean of peace?
Well, exactly. Australian government is a full member of the forum. Our prime ministers, sometimes deputy prime ministers, turn up every year. And Australia plays a disproportionate role in the forum because of its size and indeed because of its funding of many initiatives, both directly with the forum through bilateral aid programs or through funding for regional and multilateral organisations. You know, so we give a lot of money to the ADB, which flows back to the Pacific. We give a lot of money to the forum regional organisations, which is important for the smaller island countries. And so Australia is the largest and, significant member of the forum. And it uses that weight, particularly its economic and aid programs, to throw its weight around in many cases. And the forum works by consensus, and so it's often that key decisions are watered down to keep everyone happy, and that's a cause of constant problems. And that's obvious on the nuclear question. You know, Australia's commitment to the United States around AUKUS is causing a lot of questions at the moment, particularly when you see the newspaper headlines that the review of AUKUS being conducted by Elbridge Colby, a senior official in the US Department of Defense, looks like Donald Trump's administration is going to ramp up the money required not only to build submarines now in the future, but also to pay for shipyards. Australia is providing literally billions of dollars to US shipyards to improve their capacity to build submarines because the US isn't building enough submarines of their own before they'll give us submarines sometime in the never-never. The other element of this is there's been media reporting that the review may suggest that Australia must pledge that any nuclear submarines provided, Virginia-class nuclear submarines provided to Australia, have to commit to cooperation and involvement in any US war with China, probably around Taiwan or the Korean Peninsula. Fundamental questions of sovereignty. Now, these have been evident from day one, and you've seen critics ranging from civil society groups to Paul Keating and Bob Carr and beyond pointing out the obvious, that this entraps Australia into US warfighting strategies. And we already are enmeshed in those, given the presence of military bases like Pine Gap, given the rotation of US Marines and nuclear-capable B-52H bombers through Tyndall Air Base. You know, Australia is very much enmeshed in US Indo-Pacific strategy, and the desperate attempt to maintain US primacy in East Asia and Southeast Asia. Now, the Trump administration is busy destroying that by its tariff policies and its mad agendas on a whole range of issues, but it's a real challenge. Generally, Australians, because of the failure of our media, aren't aware of significant changes in the region around us, where every government and community that's facing this question are choosing sides in this battle. As one example, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the Nuclear Ban Treaty, developed and adopted in 2021, now has 93 countries that have signed. More than 70 countries have ratified it. And recently, the ratifications that occurred at the end of last year were quite significant. So Solomon Islands, for example, has joined Aotearoa New Zealand and nine other Forum Island countries to ratify TPNW, this nuclear ban treaty. So more than half the membership of the Forum has signed on, and even countries that are even members of the Forum that are not eligible to sign have expressed support for TPNW. So, for example, the Assembly of French Polynesia adopted a resolution 18 months ago supporting TPNW, calling on France to obey its provisions. Now, it's a French colony. They don't have, you know, standing under international law to sign such a treaty, but the unanimous decision of the Assembly of French Polynesia, a country that suffered 193 nuclear tests, is a symbol that the public opinion goes far beyond the governments that have ratified. It's the same in Southeast Asia. The vast majority of members of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, have signed and ratified TPNW. That includes Malaysia, Thailand, Philippines, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, and most importantly, last September, Indonesia. So Indonesia, which has a president who's been involved in war crimes in the past in Timor and West Papua, Prabowo Subianto, Indonesia has still adopted this anti-nuclear stand by ratifying TPNW, abjuring the development of nuclear weapons. And that's fundamentally important because Australia tried to develop nuclear weapons in the 1960s, fearing Indonesia as a threat from the north back in the days of the Sukarno regime. The very fact that Indonesia, facing this choice between US and Chinese tensions in the region, has said we want to maintain our history of non-aligned policy on the geopolitical stage, and Indonesia has just joined the BRICS group, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. The BRICS group has been expanding in Indonesia. President Prabowo Subianto just attended the most recent BRICS summit in Brazil. Neighbouring countries in Southeast Asia and the Pacific are working as hard as they can not to be dragged into the confrontation, the strategic confrontation between the United States and China. And that puts Australia in an invidious position, particularly within the Forum, where it's clear that the vast majority of our neighbours don't want to get dragged into the US militarisation of the region.
Has the treaty been discussed at recent Pacific Island forums?
It's sort of noted. Generally, because Australia has been opposed to signing under Richard Marles and Prime Minister Albanese, even though it's Labor Party policy to advance towards signature, because particularly to the New Zealand government under the current coalition government with Prime Minister Luxon and Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Winston Peters, they've turned very conservative at talking about joining AUKUS Pillar 2 and things like that. It's not been part of the agenda, but there's certainly strong anti-nuclear sentiment amongst Forum Island countries, the vast majority. Rumbuka's, in fact, one of the least radical members of the Pacific when it comes to these questions. You get someone like President Moatai Brotherson, who's president of French Polynesia, who, because of the terrible devastation caused by 193 atmospheric and underground nuclear tests, is pretty gung-ho on this issue of declaring the Pacific nuclear-free and addressing nuclear legacies. This is an ongoing backdrop to these debates about an ocean of peace. And I think you're going to hear Pat Conroy and Albanese stand up and say, well, we support peace in the Pacific, and that's why we're getting nuclear submarines to maintain a deterrent effect against threats to the region. But that's not going to wash with the vast majority of Pacific Islanders who are following this debate, you know, have been through the lived experience of this. The nuclear club, as we've discussed on this program many times, is pretty shameful about protecting their own. There's been a series of initiatives over the last year or so where multilateral UN agencies have been trying to push forward debate about this. So, for example, at this year's World Health Assembly, which is the global gathering of ministers for health, that's the body that determines what happens at the World Health Organization, six Pacific Island countries put forward a resolution backed by others like Kazakhstan, another country that got nuked by the Soviet Union, and that resolution passed, calling on the World Health Organization to renew its mandate around the health effects of nuclear weapons and nuclear war. Back in the 1980s, the time of the Reagan-Gorbachev arms build-up, that was on the WHO agenda, but it got dropped off. Now it's been put back on the agenda as a standing item, and the WHO will develop over the next year or so a report on the health impacts of nuclear warfare. So this is Pacific diplomacy at its best. Six countries put forward a resolution on the global stage. But you look at the countries that voted against that, obvious ones like Russia and North Korea, but also France and Britain, two countries that proclaim they're allies and partners of the Pacific, but are still maintaining their opposition to nuclear disarmament and their opposition to assistance to nuclear survivors.
You're listening to an interview with Nick McClellan, journalist with Islands Business. Well, it's months to the forum meeting. What's the likelihood that this will get up, the Ocean of Peace, or will it get knocked back because of the, like you say, it's got to be consensus?
The meeting's actually in September. It's a bit earlier this year. In fact, the 8th to the 12th, because leaders will then go on to Papua New Guinea, because the 15th of September, just a few days after the forum, is the 50th anniversary of Papua New Guinea's independence from Australia. A lot of this whole debate is tied to questions of self-determination, independence and sovereignty. And once again, the Australian media served us poorly. You know, most people don't know that Australia was the colonial power in Papua New Guinea until 1975, and this year's the anniversary. So there'll be major commemorations at that time. So the leaders are going to Honiara and Solomons for their meeting and will presumably jump on a plane, probably an Australian military plane, to fly them all to Port Moresby for the commemoration just a few days later. I think there will be a declaration. It's likely that they'll come up with some sort of wording. But like all of these things, it's a question about implementation. These are building blocks, though. Famously, in 2018, the forum adopted a declaration known as the Boy Declaration on Regional Security. Boy is a suburb in Yeren, the capital of Nauru. And the Boy Declaration talked about broadening the definition of security, regional security, not just to include state-to-state security, defence issues and so on, not just transnational crime and concern about gun running and illegal fishing and so on, but also human security and environmental security. And it famously said that the greatest single threat to livelihoods, security and well-being for Pacific peoples is climate change. So while acknowledging a spectrum of security issues, it says the biggest threat is climate change. And that's obvious. Australians should understand that. God, but look at the papers. Texans and everyone are facing the same challenge, that as Donald Trump slashes funding for the Weather Service and the NOAA in America, Texas has been hit by measles outbreaks, by natural disasters, and the US bureaucracy is incapable of dealing with this great security challenge to ordinary people. And the Pacific has been at the forefront of arguing that resources need to be redirected towards this broader notion of security. And I think the ocean of peace, while a declaration may just be a bit of paper, if it's got some content in it, people in the particularly civil society groups will continue to mobilise around that to say, OK, if you've pledged, as Australia pledged, with the Boy Declaration, that climate change is the greatest security threat, put your money where your mouth is. Let's shift resources towards that greatest threat. And that's certainly a challenge for the Albanese government, because it wants to host COP31, the 31st conference of the parties from the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. That's the annual global climate negotiations. So next year, Albanese's government wants to host COP31 in South Australia. The problem is we're competing with Turkey, another member of the Western European and others groups within the UN system, and the Turks haven't given up. Australia keeps talking as if they've got this deal in the bag, and indeed they've got endorsements from, you know, most of the Western European and others groups, from the Pacific governments and so on, to hold the thing. But Turkey, just in recent weeks, has been ramping up its campaign. One might be cynical enough to suggest the Turks are looking for a bit of a payoff to drop their campaign in a whole range of political and economic benefits, as they did when they competed with Britain back in 2021 for the Glasgow, what ended up in Glasgow. But Albanese, you know, talks the talk about climate action, but civil society groups, church groups, environmental groups across the Pacific are very worried about Australian greenwashing. And you only have to see the anger that was expressed by groups like the Pacific Islands Climate Action Network over the expansion of Northwest Shelf, one of the first major decisions by the Albanese government after re-election, saw the expansion of gas production by Woodside and other affiliates until 2070? 2070, another 45 years? That did not go down well in the Pacific, can I say. You know, Albanese, once again, it's going to say, oh, we're going to host COP31, but people will be looking for substance rather than theatre.
Well, focusing for a few moments on New Caledonia, Nick, and other colonial issues in the Pacific and elsewhere, just this first paragraph of an article. New Caledonia stands at a precipice. Political representatives from this French territory are meeting in Paris to try and eke out an agreement over its political future in the dark shadow of the violence of 2024 that saw New Caledonian burn, 14 people, 12 Kanaks and 2 military, French military killed. And that was a week ago. What's happening now, Nick?
As we speak, the talks are coming to an end. By the time this program's broadcast on Tuesday, we may have a bit more news about the outcome. The French government completely stuffed up things last year. Government under President Macron and then Interior Minister Darmanin tried to ram through changes to electoral rolls for New Caledonia's provincial assemblies and Congress without forging a consensus about those changes amongst all the different parties in New Caledonia. That was one of the drivers, indeed the trigger, for the rioting and clashes that broke out on the 13th of May last year. And as you've said, it was a terrible tragedy for New Caledonia with enormous economic destruction. One in six people in the private sector lost their jobs. I was just in New Caledonia last month. Still, there's enormous poverty. People who've lost jobs, lost livelihoods. It's been a really, really disastrous response to Macron's folly last year. Since then, the French government has recognised that, you know, there can be no political solution without engagement with the Kanak people, and particularly independence parties such as Union Caledonienne, that bring together both the majority Kanak population, but also other supporters of independence. And so since February, there's been a series of talks and then negotiations about a new political statute. For the last 25 years or more, the New Caledonia has been governed by an agreement called the Noumea Accord, which was signed back in 1998. You know, had a series of referendums, as people may recall, on this program. But the Noumea Accord stays in place until an alternative statute is agreed. And that's what these negotiations are about. There was enormous progress under Overseas Minister Manuel Valls. He put on the table a proposal that would have recognised and transferred French so-called sovereign powers to New Caledonia, albeit with a transitional period, was an unprecedented offer from the French, recognising that here we are a quarter of the way through the 21st century and they've still got responsibilities for decolonisation. But that success in May was scuttled by so-called loyalist parties, anti-independence parties, who want to remain within France. Macron himself then stepped in and called for people to come to Paris on the 2nd of July, and the talks have continued for 8 or 9 days behind closed doors. There's been remarkable radio silence. Normally political events like this leak like sieves, but as I interviewed a couple of the key participants in Noumea before they left, and you can read the stories on Ireland's business website. But since they've been in Paris, there's been remarkable discipline by all the players not to talk about what's going on. So it's quite a significant turning point. Will the French government finally acknowledge that there has to be a pathway towards a new sovereign New Caledonia? The French are proposing that there be transitional periods. I think that will be accepted to a certain extent by the independence movement, that this might take some years. If, however, it's locked in, if these questions of sovereignty and the transfer of powers over defence, police, courts, the currency and so on, are ultimately ending up with New Caledonia. The loyalists are fighting against this for obvious reasons. They want France to continue its colonial role in the region. By the time this is broadcast, I may be proven wrong, but I don't think a deal will be signed off. It may be agreed, but most parties I spoke to last fortnight, said that they wanted to go back to talk to their constituency, their electorate in the country before a deal is finalised. So it's a major step forward that people are talking, but there's still a lot of fundamental tensions between those who want to remain within France and those who say that it's inevitable that there's a new political statute moving towards a sovereign status.
There's also a report about some of the militants who were captured after the riots or during the riots and transported to France and the way they were brutally treated. But there's also the fact that the current FLNKS leader now, Christian Tien, was not allowed into the conference. His name wasn't on the invitation list.
Yeah, it's been interesting. Just last week, TV documentary was screened in France. It's amazing. For those who speak French, it's worth looking up. A TV crew followed around Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin. He's a hardliner. You know, think Peter Dutton plus Matt Canavan rolled together, and you get an idea of his style and his hardline attitude. He was one of the people who fucked up the negotiations around the political status of New Caledonia. This TV crew that was following him around for a documentary filmed him in a crisis meeting on the 18th of May, just a few days after the riots started in New Caledonia. And he was saying, we need some examples. You know, 200 people have been arrested, but we need to lock them up. I'm paraphrasing, but it's really that sort of language. And the justice minister sitting in the same meeting is filmed saying, well, hang on, there are questions of legality. Many of these kids are minors. We can't just throw them in jail. And Darmanin is saying, no, we need some examples. And just soon after that crisis meeting, 11 key CANAC leaders, including Christian Tien, the leader of the CCAT network, which was mobilising many of the protests, were seized, arrested, flown by military aircraft to France in handcuffs, and then were put into jail, many in solitary confinement, not in one jail in France, but in different jails scattered around the country. So 7 people ended up in jail in France. A couple were detained in New Caledonia. 2 women who were amongst those arrested were released into the community with ankle bracelets and, you know, home arrest. But Tien spent nearly a year in jail, most of the time in solitary confinement. But over time, a series of legal challenges and court appeals meant that the Paris Court of Appeal ruled that he should be released from prison, still under judicial control, still, you know, effectively banned from leaving New Caledonia, from talking to other people who are accused. But the most serious charges against him were effectively thrown out. He's now called an assisted witness assisting the court rather than someone who's actually been directly charged with these serious charges. And this included conspiracy to murder, conspiracy for attempted murder, organising an armed band. And the Court of Appeal in Paris basically realised that these charges were hyped up. He was hit with, as the Australians would say, the hamburger with the lot. You know, when they arrested him, flew him off, locked him up in jail for a year, the charges were obviously overblown. And so he's living in France, and he travelled to Paris, tried to get into the meeting, as you say, but was not allowed to because he wasn't invited by President Macron. However, the FLNKS held a press conference, and there's a wonderful photo of Emmanuel Tchubau, the head of the delegation from Union Caledonienne and the FLNKS, sitting next to Tien at a public press conference in Paris during these this last fortnight's negotiations. There is, you know, a whole range of signs that France's policy is falling apart, and yet France doesn't want to let go. France has strategic interests, as we've talked about many times in this program, in the so-called Indo-Pacific region. And indeed, France has been expanding its arms sales to Indonesia, to Vietnam, to Japan and other countries around the region as part of its Indo-Pacific agenda. There's big money, just as they tried to sell us $90 billion worth of submarines. So they're selling Rafale fighters to Indonesia, to India and to other countries. Big money involved in armaments. And of course, you know, we're living at a time where the Western powers are ramping up a so-called defence budget, but really warfare budgets, as they challenge Russia, China, Iran and other alleged enemies.
July the 10th was the 40th anniversary of the bombing of the original Rainbow Warrior at the Marsden Wharf in Auckland Harbour.
You know, this is another example. You know, France presents itself as a nation of laws, of human rights, of liberty, equality and fraternity. But on the 10th of July, 40 years ago, French terrorists arrived, DGSE agents from the External Intelligence Agency of France, and blew a hole in the side of the Greenpeace flagship Rainbow Warrior. They killed Fernando Pereira, 35-year-old photographer, who was one of the crew of the boat when he ran below decks to gather his cameras, and he drowned in the bombing. You know, Australia played a sordid role in this. The four of the actual bombers escaped on a yacht, which ended up at Norfolk Island. They were on Norfolk Island for 24 hours, and the New Zealand government was desperately trying to get the evidence where they could be charged, but Australia let them go, and they sailed away to France, never to face judicial proceedings, the actual bombers. Some of the other people were caught who'd been involved in setting up the bombings, two of whom ended up on Hau Atoll in French Polynesia for about 3 weeks before they were let go and sent back to Paris and given medals. It was a sordid, sordid example of state power. The Greenpeace vessel had just been in the Marshall Islands, helping relocate people from Rongelap Island, an island scarred by US nuclear testing. The last voyage of the Rainbow Warrior is documented in a series of documentaries. A wonderful book by New Zealand journalist David Robey, who was on the boat, Eyes of Fire, has just been republished in a new edition, but you could find it. It's a wonderful book, Eyes of Fire. It includes Roby's text and photos by Fernando Pereira, who was martyred by these French terrorist actions. It's an important commemoration because, you know, there was a long struggle during the 1980s to end testing, which succeeded in the mid-90s. 1996 was the last test. And just last week, a major report came out from the French National Assembly, led by a pro-independence Tahitian delegate, Mariana Riud-Abelo. This very detailed report with dozens and dozens of recommendations to the French about compensation, about cleanup, about integrating knowledge of the nuclear era into schools, about apologies and memorialization. It's a really important report and shows that here we are 40 years after the bombing of Rainbow Warrior, 80 years on the 6th of August of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima, the nuclear legacies that affected the Asia-Pacific region are still with us, and people are still fighting to remember but also address the health, environmental and cultural consequences of the nuclear era.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Thanks as always, Jan. Look forward to speaking with you again.
Many thanks, Nick McClellan. And as Nick referred to in that interview, which we recorded last Friday, France has announced a so-called historic deal with New Caledonia, in which the South Pacific Overseas Territory, which was rocked by a wave of unrest last year over controversial electoral reforms, will be declared a new state. I'll be speaking with Nick again next week for his assessment of the decisions.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter. Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now. The Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
We hear now the second and final part of the country profile for this month with Sasha Gillies-Likakis, activist, teacher, broadcaster. And the country is Uruguay in the south of South America.
Now, of course, what saved them this time was that Argentina had now fully finished its process of liberation, and it was led by Manuel de Rosas. Rosas supported the Cisplatine Republic, ultimately ensured their independence in a treaty that was signed with Brazil in 1828. And so in 1828, we see the creation, the proper creation of the Republic of Uruguay, due to Argentina's very timely intervention against the Brazilians. Following independence, Uruguayan politics virtually mimicked Argentina's dichotomy of liberal and conservative, as in most Latin American countries. But it was a little bit different. So we had what were called the Colorados, the Reds, or the Coloureds, which is the very literal translation, known for their red armbands, which were the liberal faction of the revolutionary generation. So these men were proponents of a, you know, centralized control in Montevideo, but economically they were proponents of a free market regime, forging closer ties with Brazil and with Britain and all of these types of imperial powers, but socially, you know, were more in favor of secularizing the governments, reducing the power of the Catholic Church, all of this type of, you know, more socially progressive policy. On the other side, we had the Blancos, the whites, who were the conservative faction who represented the interests of the rural elite. They were more aligned with Argentina's government, with Rosas, who were socially very reactionary, extremely in favor of the Catholic Church and of the church maintaining its power. But economically, they wanted this more sovereignist, more economically just sort of system that was a bit more redistributive amongst everyday Uruguayans. These were essentially the sides, the parties of a new civil war that took place from the early 1830s that lasts right up until 1852. And this is called La Guerra Grande, because it didn't just encompass Uruguay, it also encompassed Argentina, who was supporting the Blancos and who was fighting its own war against the other side of this conflict, which was Britain, France, Brazil, and the Colorados in Uruguay. The liberals in Uruguay had aligned with the exiled liberals from Argentina, who were launching cross-border skirmishes into Argentina. In turn, these two groups were financed and directly supported militarily by the British, the French, and the Brazilians, who were looking to break Rosas and his government, of course, because of this independent economic and foreign policy that Rosas had. And on the other side, we, of course, had the Rosas government and the Blancos in Uruguay. This was a very long war. We're talking two decades of conflict. You know, Montevideo was besieged multiple times, razed to the ground on several occasions. And at the time as well, we saw the genocide of the indigenous people take place. And this was committed by both sides, but mostly by the Colorados, the liberals. There was a very, very brutal massacre at Salsipuedes, which is a town in Uruguay today, where almost the entire Charrua population was murdered. By this time, there's a few thousand Charrua left, and the majority of them were killed in this massacre at Salsipuedes as the civil war is raging. And as this Guerra Grande between the different powers of South America is raging, Uruguay essentially completes its massacre of the last firm, consistent indigenous group that was still intact at the time. And we see continuous persecution of the few remaining indigenous people in Uruguay. Today, it's only about 2% of the population claims to have any indigenous blood, and there's very, very few full-blooded indigenous people in Uruguay today because of how comprehensive this policy of genocide was that went under the radar because, of course, we were looking at this larger conflict between the Colorados and the Blancos, and a lot of people forget what happened to the indigenous people, that regardless of which side, both of them were extremely hostile to the indigenous people. Critically, I just wanted to mention a very key historical figure that often gets talked about in the context of the Italian unification wars, Giuseppe Garibaldi, who was a very famous revolutionary in Italy's unification wars against the conservatives. He actually started his revolutionary career in Uruguay. He was a math teacher in Montevideo, and he would join the Colorados liberals, who, you know, I suppose for the time were the more progressive side socially, that he started his revolutionary journey in Uruguay before going back to Italy to resolve matters over there. But by the end of the war, this is about the late 1840s, early 1850s, we see Rosas deposed. Ultimately, the sanctions and the blockades begin to work. The British, the French, the Brazilians, and the exiled liberals from Argentina basically break the government, the Argentinian government, and the liberals take over. The same thing happens in Montevideo, in Uruguay. The Colorados storm the main bastion of Blanco support in the countryside. Fructuoso Rivera, who is the first president of, you know, or the first solely recognized president, because there's no Blancos in power anymore, he comes to preside over a Colorado liberal regime. Now, what happens after this is the Brazilians and the British and the French essentially come to create a neo-colony. The Brazilians force the Uruguayans to sign 5 treaties that create perpetual alliance with Brazil. So this subordinates the Uruguayan armed forces to the Brazilian army. Brazil gains the right to intervene militarily in Uruguay whenever it wants without consultation. Uruguay has to give 176,000 square kilometers of land on its northern border to Brazil. Adding further insult to injury, Brazil forces through exclusive access to the Laguna Merin, which is a very important river, and the Rio Jaguaron on the border with Uruguay, which is, again, a critical artery for maritime trade for Uruguay and the Brazilians, who then also grant rights to the French and the British, particularly the British, gain exclusive access to these waterways at the expense of Uruguayan commerce. So Uruguay is de facto turned into a Brazilian colony at this point, even though it's nominally independent. But of course, the Colorado regime is totally in the pockets of the Brazilians and of the British financiers that are also virtually controlling Brazilian banks by this point. In the 1860s, Brazil does intervene militarily because an elected Blanco government, the first time a Blanco government is elected in Uruguay since the Great War, the Guerra Grande, encourages them to intervene, is that Uruguay under the Blancos in 1864 forged closer ties with Paraguay, this proto-socialist country that had become completely self-sufficient, that had a strong army, that was completely self-contained with its industry, its food production, poverty eliminated, universal healthcare and basic education. And of course, this was in the crosshairs now of the Argentinian liberal regime, which had come to power after the war, and the Brazilians and the British, who wanted to break Paraguay. And they saw this new Uruguayan Blanco government wanting to sign a military pact with Paraguay so that they could defend each other against these imperial powers. So in 1864, we see this Blanco government come to power and make overtures to Paraguay and also begin to mimic the Paraguayan economic model or attempt to. And so the Brazilians invade Uruguay again. They overthrow the Blanco government and they reinstall a Colorado liberal regime. This then prompts the horrific Paraguayan war, which sees, of course, Paraguay commits itself to defending Uruguay, and they blockade the rivers and the tributaries along the Rio Paraguay, which causes a lot of economic damage to that part of southern Brazil and to Argentina because of their warmongering and their support for this intervention against the Uruguayan Blancos. Then, of course, we see the intervention of Brazil, Argentina, the new Uruguayan liberal regime, and the British, of course, financing all of this, invading Paraguay from 1864 to 1870, a horrifically brutal war in the jungles of Latin America, where three quarters of Paraguay's population is massacred by the invading forces, three quarters of the population genocided. And Uruguay, of course, was complicit in this war. They didn't get anything out of it at the end. All of the resources and the riches were divided between the Brazilians and the Argentinians and the British. That just goes to show that when Uruguay did try to reclaim that independence, it was totally and utterly crushed by the imperial powers in this region and, of course, by the British at the time, who throughout this period are expressing keen interest in exploiting and controlling Latin America's resources. And really, after the Uruguayan involvement in the Paraguayan War, undisputed Colorado rule from 1870 up until the 1970s, when there's a military regime comes to power. But throughout this period, throughout the latter half of the 19th century, so from the 1870s onwards, we begin to see, you know, the concentration of wealth within this Montevideo-based elite, as happens in Buenos Aires. Montevideo becomes quite a wealthy city, as does Buenos Aires. Gradual moves towards industrialization, as happens in Argentina, the formation of quite a large working class. This is, of course, accompanied by labor strikes, by the creation of very militant trade unions, because Uruguay, relative to a lot of other countries in the region, is prosperous at this time. It is, at least on the surface, you know, the economy is growing, there is industrialization, there are more industrially based jobs being created. But of course, this wealth is concentrated in the hands of a merchant elite. Poverty does continue to rise alongside these economic advances. We do see a very significant migration from Europe, a mass migration from Europe, from Italy, from Spain chiefly, and from Portugal as well. This was an attempt to whiten Uruguay. So a very, very twisted sort of eugenicist-oriented migration foreign policy. There was also the practical dimension of needing more workers for this industrialization that was taking place. Today, the majority of Uruguayans are of European descent, and the African population continues to be marginalized in Uruguay. We do see the growth of these militant trade unions, which are traditions that are also imported from Italy and Spain. Particularly throughout the 1910s and 20s, we begin to see these big waves of rolling strikes in the industrial sector, in the meat processing sector, particularly in the meat export sector. As I mentioned, this is now what is driving Uruguay's economic growth. It is the livestock sector and the export of lamb and cattle, and then also horses for labor, for, you know, everyday uses. In particular, in the 1910s and the 1920s, policies of what is called the Batlle era. And this is named after the liberal president, José Batlle, who was dominant throughout the 1910s and 1920s, who represented the most radical faction of the liberals. So he actually secularized completely the government in Uruguay by this point, and he implemented very, very progressive social policies, powered the trade unions, which was his support base, really, broadened education and health access, gave full voting rights to women as well, which is one of the first countries in the world to do so at the time, which is very, very significant. This period is really what propelled Uruguay's reputation as a progressive, forward-moving country. Now, this was interrupted and sort of broken by the Great Depression in 1929, where the UK, to defend its own industry, stopped importing Uruguayan meat and livestock products. And this was the main source of revenue for Uruguay. One of its major partners, again, a legacy of this imperial history, was the United Kingdom. And so what happened was we saw a depression in Uruguay. Batlle attempted to nationalize some of the key industries, including a lot of the livestock producing farms and the livestock production factories. And this, of course, was very, very radical for the time. And it was received with a lot of hostility by other members of the Colorado government. And in particular, we saw Gabriel Terra, who was a very, very conservative Colorado, and he launched a military coup against Batlle. He was very opposed to this nationalization program, and the army and the police supported this military coup. And he essentially implemented a very, very stringently free market economic model, which dramatically increased poverty and insecurity in Uruguay at this time. And that was kept in check. The idea, Terra's idea, was that this would be kept in check by the military and the police, so that we saw more social unrest, we saw more poverty, violence, but that the military and the police could essentially deal with that while the free market policies were implemented to benefit the Uruguayan elite and benefit, of course, all of these other foreign companies that then were more attracted again by Uruguay's livestock industry. This lasted, not Terra himself, but the Terra-aligned governments would last until 1947. Uruguay was really not that involved in World War II. Ultimately, they did come down on the side of the Allies because they were so close to the United Kingdom politically, and also, of course, the United States, which really is not taking an interest in Uruguay at this point. That doesn't happen until the 1970s. And even then, this is an incidental sort of interest in the context of the wider sort of changes that are happening in Latin America, the more radical changes. But at this point, Uruguay is sort of just continuing its free market trajectory. There is now documented evidence of the CIA and MI6 essentially corrupting those few more progressive members of the Colorados and also the more nationalistic members of the Blancos, which is now the National Party by this point, the Nacionales, to the point where these two parties are virtually indistinguishable. But by the late 40s, early 50s, the Nacionales, formerly the Blancos, and the Colorados, who retain that name to this day, are virtually the same. Very, very hostile by this point to the trade union and the workers' movements, and in particular, very hostile to any sort of mention of socialism or communism, which is beginning to creep into the trade union movement at this point by the 50s. And we begin to see sweeping trade union mobilizations, national strikes, which paralyze Uruguay, student movements as well in the universities of Montevideo, of which there are a number. Uruguay has a very proud intellectual tradition. And of course, we also see the emergence of a communist movement, which are the Tupamaros in the late 60s. And the Tupamaros also have a branch in Argentina, even in Chile as well, and in Paraguay. Tupamaros were essentially the main communist force in Uruguay at the time. They were inspired by the Cuban Revolution, and they begin a guerrilla campaign against the Colorado regime. Throughout the 60s, we begin to see, you know, really, the Colorados are losing control of the country. You know, the trade union movements are paralyzing the economy. Uruguay has entered another depression by this point because of this very militant and proud union activity, which is putting pressure on the elites. The elites are struggling and they don't know what to do. Not to mention there's now the Tupamaro movement, which is comparatively, it's a small guerrilla movement if we compare it to other movements in Latin America. But, you know, it still counts upon thousands of members, and they are putting pressure on the police in rural areas, on the armed forces. And a very important president, Pepe Mujica, who would become the president of Uruguay in the late 2000s, very progressive president, he is a part of the Tupamaro movement at this time as well. So what happens is we see the situation in Uruguay deteriorating dramatically, and the Colorados and the Nacionales are paralyzed. The United States begins to take an interest here. Incidental interest in Uruguay, because the US is more concerned with Chile and Argentina and Brazil. And they've, of course, implemented, or they're beginning to lay the groundwork for the very notorious military dictatorships that are going to be taking over in all three of these big countries surrounding Uruguay. Not to mention, they're already supporting Alfredo Stroessner, the Nazi-linked military dictator in Paraguay. All these dominoes are falling to the military, the CIA-backed military regimes. And, of course, the United States wants to make sure that Uruguay is not the weak link. They want to make sure that the entire southern cone is militarized and controlled by these dictatorships so that there isn't any sort of successful communist uprising. And it looked like it was going to get to that point in Uruguay, that at the very least there was going to be some sort of progressive force. I mean, in the early 70s, 71, the Frente Amplio, the Broad Front, created, which is an alliance of left-wing parties, including Tupamaro-linked parties, which were the largest faction within that grouping at the time. The CIA, much like in Brazil, Chile, Argentina, finances a military takeover in Uruguay. They provide weapons to the armed forces, military instructors. The Colorados and the Nacionales, they agree to facilitate this military regime. So this is not an overthrow of the Colorados. The Colorados willingly let the military take control of the streets. And this is supported by the Nacionales, supposedly their former adversaries, who both support this very, very brutal military dictatorship. And this comes to power in 73, just a few years after the Frente Amplio is created. They militarize the country. According to official statistics, they kill about 500 people. Again, the suggestion based on testimonies, based on family members of the desaparecidos, the disappeared, is that it does run into the thousands in reality. Massive emigration from Uruguay at this time, not just political opponents of this military regime, but everyday Uruguayans, because the country continues to suffer through a depression period. You know, the military is not popular and it's isolated as well. Even in Latin America, you know, Uruguay's military regime is not favored by the other military regimes in the region. They are instead orienting their commerce towards the British and the Americans. And of course, when you've got Brazilian and Argentinian livestock competing with Uruguay, there's no way anyone's going to pick Uruguay. The country stagnates. The largest per capita percentage of political prisoners in the world in Uruguay. You know, this is an extremely violent and paranoid regime that that takes over, and we begin to see the streets are emptying. People are leaving Uruguay en masse during this military regime. But they succeed in breaking the Tupamaros. They kill the leaders of the Tupamaros and jail many of the others, including Pepe Mujica, who rots in prison, in a solitary confinement prison for 13 years. They break the communist movement. The trade union movement, they do not break. They control it and they contain it, but they do not break it. Really, by 1985, we see an agreement to transition back to quote-unquote civilian rule. And this was agreed to between the United States and the military, of course, because the other military dictatorships are also giving up their power. So there's elections. Again, it's between the Colorados and the Nacionales. Colorados win, of course. They virtually continue the policies of the military regime, the free market policies. They release political prisoners, the military regime jailed. However, they also grant total amnesty to the generals and the colonels that led this military regime. And this was a very faceless military regime. When we look at Chile, we have Pinochet as the figurehead. When we look at Argentina, we have Videla. Brazil, there are a number of very high-profile military generals like Branco. But with Uruguay, it's sort of this transition, this like endless slew of military bureaucrats that continues to take over. And that shows how managed and controlled the military regime was in Uruguay. You know, that it was fully supported by the parties, the Colorados and the Nacionales. It was a very smooth sort of process as far as the administration of the government was. It didn't collapse. It gave power back to the civilian administration, knowing that they would protect the military regime. And so there's been no redress for these crimes. There's been no investigation. There's been no commission of truth as there was in Argentina. And these generals have essentially been allowed to escape scot-free, and they don't have power, political power, so to speak, anymore, but they do have a lot of money. These people made a lot of money during the military era, and they still enjoy those spoils. But what happens now is we have the Colorados, who fully implement neoliberalism. Before, you know, of course, we had the free market orientation, but now we were getting to the late 80s, early 90s, and the Colorados fully steam ahead with neoliberalism. This also leads to a very similar crisis as to what happened in Argentina, because Uruguay taking out huge loans from the World Bank, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of loans to keep their ailing economy afloat. We begin to see as well poverty increasing dramatically. The Argentinian debt crisis leads to an almost total collapse of Uruguay's banking system, because the two are very, very closely interlinked. The Brazilian real, the Brazilian currency, devalues as well because of neoliberal reforms. And again, cross-border commerce and a lot of transactions are conducted in the Brazilian real, in the Brazilian currency. So this leads to a huge crisis in Uruguay, where the country is brought to the brink of economic collapse. 20% of Uruguayans unemployed and 40% of Uruguayans living in poverty. So rolling protests across the country. And again, these are led by the trade unions and by the Frente Amplio, which is that left-wing political grouping, which is now, of course, legalized again in the wake of the military regime. Public opinion swings hugely against neoliberalism. The country is virtually destroyed at this point, much like in the case of Argentina. This culminates in a huge victory for the Frente Amplio in the 2004 elections. This is a grouping, as I mentioned, of the left-wing parties. Some are communist, socialist, but then, of course, there are the much more moderate social democrats and centre-left parties. But they have a huge victory in the elections. The Colorado Party has never recovered from this electoral loss, where the Nacional Party, the Partido Nacional, formerly the Blancos, are now the main opposition and have been since 2004. So this really showed a strong rejection of neoliberalism and its proponents. And the Frente Amplio was led at that time by Tabaré Vázquez, who was the former mayor of Montevideo. They implement very, very progressive reforms, essentially claw back all of the neoliberal policies. They restore the control of the state in key industries, including livestock, renegotiate their debt agreements and their loans from the World Bank. They still have the loans, but they negotiate much more favorable terms. Dramatic expansion in social services, social welfare, huge poverty alleviation measures, which, you know, really sort of strengthen the popularity of the Frente Amplio among the working class. This is really, really important in a country that has just almost been brought to the brink of collapse by neoliberalism. And they win again in 2010, which is led by, this time, the Frente Amplio is led by José Pepe Mujica, sometimes just known as Pepe Mujica. He was a part of the Tupamaros group. He spent time in jail during the military regime. And he continues and expands this very, very progressive social policy and economic policy. We see abortion is legalized, same-sex marriage, marijuana use, which is a little bit more controversial in Uruguay. That didn't pass by a huge majority, and it has caused a few issues now with drug trafficking. There is a bit of an issue with that at the moment in Uruguay. But these poverty measures and socially progressive policies also expand critically to the trade union. José Mujica actually incentivizes with payments association with trade unions, to the point where, as of today, there are about 400,000 trade union members in Uruguay out of a population of 1.5 million. So I'm pretty certain that is the highest percentage in the world of trade union members in Uruguay. So the trade unions enjoy immense power and popularity in Uruguay because of the Frente Amplio's policies. And this has meant generally that there have been quite stable and quite good conditions in Uruguay for workers up until recently, a reason behind the popularity of the Frente Amplio. What has happened more recently, we begin to see this when you have a Frente Amplio coalition where there are diverse interests in varying degrees of radicalism. You can see the policies change over time as the party gets more institutionalized first. Pepe Mujica was a very, very strong proponent of ties with Cuba, with Venezuela, a very big supporter of a lot of the Latin American integration projects of Lula in Brazil. You know, they are still domestically progressive and, you know, they're still in power. There was a brief break in 2015 where the Nacionales Blancos won an election, tried to re-implement neoliberalism, unsurprisingly very unpopular, and the Frente Amplio regained power. We saw a bit of a turn, you know, particularly among questions of foreign policy. Pepe Mujica has, you know, turned against, for example, Venezuela, generally speaking. Then they've distanced themselves a bit from Brazil politically as well. They've distanced themselves from Lula a bit. And they've sort of, I guess, veered a bit towards that sort of soft left-wing government in Latin America that maybe, if we look at the case of Chile, for example, where, you know, they don't really take principled stances on a lot of important questions and have sort of shied away from being a bit more radical and bold in what they used to say, that there are internal machinations at play amongst the broad front in Uruguay. you know, this happens when a party has been in power for quite a while. You know, we're talking 25 years almost. Do institutionalize, and there are people now with vested interests in the Frente Amplio that maybe are sort of just keen on keeping the party machine running. Not to say that there aren't progressives there, and I think the progressives are still very important, pushing, you know, for keeping the radical reforms domestically in Uruguay. But it's important to note, you know, that I think maybe the Frente Amplio got a little bit complacent. We can see there's been a little bit of an increase in poverty. The fact that they lost to the Nacional Party is also indicative that maybe there was a bit of dissatisfaction among their base with these sorts of, you know, maybe not pushing forward with these radical projects that they'd begun or that they promised. But look, by and large, I have to say Uruguay continues to serve as an example of, you know, what can happen. You know, when there are progressive policies implemented, it is a very stable country in Latin America. There are very powerful progressive forces that continue to have control of key institutions in Uruguay. And I hope the progressive elements in the Frente Amplio will continue to be able to advocate for their support base. The trade unions will continue to be powerful, and that Uruguay will continue to move in that sort of left-wing progressive direction.
And we'll hear more from Sasha Gillies-Lacagas next month with another country profile.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.